We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other will both get value from the episode.
So today I am talking with Jonathan Stark, who many of you probably know because we tend to have kind of overlapping audiences. One of the things that Jonathan is very passionate about, thinks a lot about, has written a lot about is how freelancers and entrepreneurs go about charging money for their work. And he has a website called The Very Expensive Problem and wrote a book called Hourly Billing is Nuts, and is just really active in helping freelancers and entrepreneurs think about different ways of billing. So I'm super excited that Jonathan is here. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to talk a little bit about how, as a founder, as an entrepreneur, you can take good care of yourself by valuing your resources and assets well. And that means charging well. So Jonathan knows all about that, and I'm looking forward to talking to him because sometimes I still charge hourly.
Oh no, I admitted it. Well, hourly billing is the default route for most people who maybe when they first start freelancing or even years and years after they've been solo working for themselves, even if they have a firm, it's a common model for lots of professions, you know, not just developers or designers, but also lawyers, chiropractors, so on and so forth. So it's the de facto approach for most people, but I see it as a major problem. Sometimes I go so far as to say it's a cancer on professional services because it leaves most people operating at cost, which is to say they're not making any profit. And the result of operating at cost, especially over the long term, is that you are burned out. You are working sometimes more than ever. After 10 years, you're working more than ever, and you still feel like you're barely making ends meet. It's like a hamster wheel kind of feeling. And you're operating at such a low margin that if something happens, like, say, you have a whale client and they unexpectedly leave you, or a project falls through at the last minute, you're left scrambling for cash flow. And that is a horrible feeling. You know, I'm a little on the older side. I'm going to be 49 in a couple of months. And, you know, as you age as a freelancer or a consultant, you get more and more responsibilities. I think that's a fair assumption. So, you know, I've got a family, a mortgage, a wife stays at home, two kids, two dogs, two cars, you know, the usual thing. So when you've got a solo income like that, if you are essentially living hand to mouth, even if you're making six figures, but you're still living hand to mouth, it's extremely stressful. And I'm sure everyone's familiar with that.
Yeah, I think you're speaking the language of many of the people who listen to the show who are either bootstrapping a business or maybe still kind of working full time and then doing some side work to work towards more autonomy and independence.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like my value proposition at Expensive Problem is to help people increase their profits, not their revenue. I think business growth is really the only metric that's not vanity, is increased profits. Because you can increase your revenue all day long, but you can still be making no money. You can be adding headcount all day long, but, you know, being more and more stressed out and having less time for yourself. You can be getting a bigger office. You can be doing all of these things that maybe impress your parents because it's this sort of easy to understand metric. But if you're not increasing your profits, you're not growing, in my opinion. I know people disagree with that, but that's my feeling.
So why not just charge a higher hourly rate?
Great question. So, man, where do you start? So that's a great question. And
sorry, we're starting really, this is the kindergarten level here.
It really is good though, because the problem with increasing your hourly rate is, as anybody knows who's listening to this, is that they sense that there's a market rate for what they do. And they're kind of right. because the whole concept of pricing professional services and creative work and this sort of info knowledge work that we all do, there are enough examples of people who do what you do that clients have a sense of how much you should charge per hour. So if you dramatically increase that, because you would have to, in most cases, you'd have to pretty much double it to start to have profits, to have like a what I would consider normal level of profits, you're going to look like the world's most expensive whatever you do. Regardless of how fast you do it, regardless of how effective you are, when someone's shopping around, they'll usually, you know, they'll contact you maybe through your website, or they'll send you an email and say, hey, I heard that you do WordPress development. We've got some WordPress work that needs to be done. What's your hourly rate? And people will happily say, oh, my hourly rate's $100 an hour or $200 an hour. And the client, and both of you are acting totally irrationally at that moment, because it doesn't matter technically what your hourly rate is if you don't know how long the project's going to take. So when the client asks you that question, what's your hourly rate, and then makes a judgment based on it, which they do, because if I said $500 an hour, they would hang up on me. They would never ask, well, how many hours is it going to take? They would hang up before they ask that question.
You're looking at one metric, but only one metric.
Right. It's only half the equation. And it's only a third of the equation, because quality is not considered there. Guarantees are not considered. Risk management's not considered. I mean, they're leaving out a ton of meaningful factors to a purchase decision, but they're usually maybe overwhelmed is the wrong word, but maybe they just don't know how to compare WordPress developer A to WordPress developer B. So they default to the sort of last refuge of the bad marketer. They look for the lowest price. And everybody in this situation is confusing the hourly rate with a price, which it is not. It is very much not a price. So it's a long answer to your question, but you basically can't double your hourly rate or you'll never get any work.
So one of the things that I know you talk a lot about and walk people through as a coach and in the podcast and other things that you're involved with is helping people figure out how to talk to their clients about what their clients need, and then assessing the value that they bring to the client. So I have that right, more or less?
Yes, very good. Yes. So if somebody, when people do contact me about my technology consulting business, I still do mobile consulting for credit unions. When someone does contact me, if they did say something like, hey, you know, we need somebody to help us design a conversational interface for our account balance thing, and then they say, what's your hourly rate? I'd say, oh, I don't have an hourly rate. And I would just let the dead silence stretch.
Just let it sit there.
Yeah.
In suspense.
Right. And it just like, I wouldn't hem and haw or be like, oh, I prefer not to bill by the hour, or, you know, I don't get into it. I'm just like, oh, I don't have an hourly rate. And then I let it sit there. And then they're sort of like, well, how do you bill for your services? And I say, well, I'll give you a price for the project, so you know, before we start, how much is going to cost? Would that be okay? Or do you have to have an hourly rate? And they'll 90% of the time they say, oh yeah, that'd be great. You know, they're like, wow, a price? An actual price? That'd be amazing. I mean, it's the way we buy virtually everything in our lives. Like, first we see the price and then we decide if we want to spend the money. Where the hourly thing, especially for an ongoing collaborative project, like most creative work can be, not most, but lots of creative work, project work is a collaboration that takes place over months or, you know, weeks or maybe many months, or maybe over a year.
So that sounds super logical and makes great sense the way that you talk about it, right? You say, this is the price for this project based on your ability to listen to what the client is needing. So like, why does nobody do that then?
Because it's kind of hard. I'll be totally honest. All right. So the process I use for pricing project work, not all my work, but my project work, is known as value-based pricing. So, you know, if we continue that conversation from, I don't have an hourly rate, well, how do you price your work? Well, we'll talk about the project and I'll give you a price for it so you can make a informed decision. And they'll say, all right, well, how does that work? And I'll say, well, if we're not already on a phone call, usually this part of the conversation takes place over email, but let's say we're on a phone call. I'll say, well, tell me about the project. You know, what are you guys thinking right now? And then the person will tend to go on like a 10 to 15, sometimes maybe 20 minute brain dump of of all this tactical stuff that's right in front of them that they think that you're going to do for them. They say, hey, here are all these things that we want you to do for us. All the background, they need to get it all off their chest. Like, you have to let them get it out because it's kind of pent up. Usually when someone is contacting me, I think this is true for a lot of people. I hear it from my students as well. They have already failed repeatedly at doing this internally, and now they're under some kind of time pressure. So they're stressed out. Their boss is probably dropping a hammer and they've got all this pent up anxiety. And so I just let them vent it for up to say 20, 25 minutes. And then I'll say, wow, thanks for all that information. It's super helpful, which is sometimes maybe not true. Sometimes I don't even understand what they're talking about because they haven't given me enough context, but I let them get it off their chest.
You're just being empathetic in that moment. You're appreciating their emotions about it.
Exactly. I'm taking furious notes, And some of it will end up being useful and some of it will make sense. But a lot of times they haven't even told me some very basic things about their business. Like, you know, they might start off without even telling me what kind of business they're in or how they make money or how they get clients. It's some real basic stuff that's obvious to them, but not me. So that's what I'll do next is back them up and have what I call a why conversation. So I'll ask a series of questions that get answers to three categories of why questions. So why this, why now, and why me? And underneath each of those is a sort of series based on what I've heard from them. I'll have a, you know, slightly different approach to each group of questions. But essentially what happens is I'll say, okay, you know, you're telling me that you want this fancy skill for Google Home or Alexa or something like that to do this thing. Why did you decide to solve it in this way? Why couldn't you just hire more customer service people or put more people in the call center? Why not just do this manually? Why use software as the solution? You know, that sort of thing. And they'll say, well, we thought about that and we can't do it because of X, Y, and Z. So I'll say, okay, I'm sort of inside. I'm like, okay, I'm convinced that software is really the only approach here, the only feasible approach based on their situation. Then I'll move into the why now questions, which amount to things like, well, you know, you mentioned that you've been having this problem or you noticed this problem 6 months ago. What changed that is forcing you to suddenly deal with it? Or I'll say something like, you know, you just discovered this problem. Maybe you should study it for 6 months or a year and find out if it's actually a big deal before embarking on this, what will surely be an expensive, risky, long-term, resource-intensive project. And they'll have an answer because they almost always have their hair on fire. They'll say, well, you know, we have a new CEO and they're cleaning house and this has been something that we've needed to deal with for a long time and we haven't, and maybe I'll lose my, you know, whatever. There's some kind of time pressure. So I'll say, okay, I'm convinced that this needs to happen right away. And then the last thing, category of questions is why me? Why would you hire someone expensive like me to do this when you could hire internal employees to do it? In fact, I can help you do that with a separate service, or I could say, well, why don't you outsource this to Croatia? I know a dev firm over there that does this kind of thing. Maybe you guys can just manage it yourself. And I'll basically raise every possible objection because I know I'm going to be one of, if not the most expensive looking option for this project. So I try to pull out every possible price objection on the phone while I'm meeting with them, because that's the best place to address those things as opposed to in print in a proposal. And I'll get an answer. And if they convince me, I basically try to talk them out of working with me. And if I can't convince them that they should do something cheaper or just in a way that is doesn't involve hiring me, then what has happened is I've convinced myself that there's a good fit here, and they've convinced themselves that they should hire me. So by the time I take all of those, you know, I'll have like six pages of notes at this point, and then I can turn around and take their language that came out of their mouths literally and put it into the proposal, which ends up being like a slam dunk in most cases, unless I have wildly miscalculated the value of this project. So in a conversation like I've just described, eventually you're going to get down to some sort of numbers or some sort of urgency or some sort of risk that is measurable in some way. So they know they have a problem because they're measuring something, and I'll find out what it is and I'll get a sense of what financial impact that is, you know, either a negative financial impact it's having on their business or potential opportunity for growth. You know, let's just say it's $1 million a year. I'll price myself at a tenth of that and add a couple of incremental options on top of that. And then I'll figure out what service I can provide for at those prices that's fair for me. And usually it's kind of a no-brainer because they're like, wow, he's right. I mean, we don't have to hire 25 more people in the call center if we do this. And that right there is $250,000 a year in savings, fully loaded cost for employees. So $25,000 is a no-brainer.
So once you have the metric with which they are using to essentially like pursue you, like the metric that they is their pain point, the thing that they're trying to grow or reduce, then you really have a sense of where you are in their internal market.
Right. But you get a sense of what it's worth to their business.
Their value, your value to them, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's totally subjective. So I could talk to a credit union that has $2 billion in assets and in my head be imagining a series of activities that I'm going to undertake on their behalf. And maybe it's going to take me 40 hours. Let's just say it's going to take me 40 hours. The value of that 40 hours of effort is going to be way more valuable to a $2 billion credit union than it would be to a $1 million credit union. So even though I could do the exact same activities for a $1 million credit union, I could never charge them as much as I would charge the $2 billion organization because it's just not worth that much to them. They're not going to get positive ROI on a big price tag, you know, paying me a lot of money because they just don't have a way to capture that value because they're too small.
So all of this sounds very reasonable and logical. What breaks down? Like, why doesn't everyone do it this way? Because you said it's hard, right? So there's this potential that one, you don't know how to listen well, or two, that you miscalculate. What else?
The listening is the biggest one. The listening is absolutely the biggest one. So, well, there's an even bigger one, I suppose, which is that it's such a foreign approach. So telling people that you're going to give them an actual price when they've got an RFP out and they've gotten 10 estimates back. They'll call them quotes, but they're not quotes, they're estimates. They get all these estimates back with hourly rate and they jump to the hourly rate and they say, okay, these people are charging $100 an hour. These people are charging $300 an hour. That's crazy. How could they charge that much per hour? I wouldn't pay anybody $300 an hour for anything. And everybody's thinking about the wrong thing. So sometimes I'll have a conversation with a prospect where they literally have to get an hourly rate because they've got some outdated or Byzantine procurement process that maybe is a government regulation that says that they absolutely have to get hourly rates from everybody and they have to pick the cheapest one. So that's not a good client. So I'd just be like, no thanks.
Yeah, that's not a good client for lots of reasons.
It's a non-starter. So, oh, by the way, that's why software projects so often go over estimate because people lowball on the estimate to get the work. And then the thing goes way over because they were being unrealistic in the first place.
Yeah.
The main problem though is the listening, because having that conversation that I just said, I mean, imagine you've only gotten maybe you don't get a lot of leads and this big fish comes along and says, hey, I'd like to talk to you about a project. You're all excited. Your mortgage payment's coming due and you would just love to get some cash from this company. And then I'm telling you to go in there and try to talk them out of hiring you. It seems counterintuitive, but it has this effect of attracting the right kind of clients and repelling the wrong kind of clients. So you do need to have some sort of financial stability before, most people need to have some sort of financial stability before they can truly engage in a conversation like this.
Because what gets in the way is the scarcity mentality. And sometimes there's literal scarcity. I mean, if you really don't have enough to cover your mortgage this month, like, I understand that's sort of a different problem. But I think sometimes people carry over scarcity mentality and this sense of like, I need to get more, I need to get more, I need to get more clients, and which keeps them from taking risks like the one that you're talking about, and maybe keeps them even from listening well.
Absolutely. I find that most people who start to attempt to have these kinds of conversations, because I coach dozens and dozens of people through this process, and they all do the same thing, which is that they don't go deep enough. So they'll get an answer from the client. The client will say something, and then they'll push back once, and they'll say, "Well, why is that a big deal for you guys? Why is the bounce rate on your website such a big deal to you guys?" And they'll say, "Well, because we're not converting that traffic." Then they'll just give up. They'll be like, "Okay, I asked a why question. Whew." But the answer that they got back is not yet meaningful. They need to go deeper and find out. I tell them, in your head, keep saying to yourself, so what? Just keep saying so what over and over again. Politely, you express that in a more polite way. But the client says, oh, because we're not converting those. And then your mind says, so what? Don't assume that you understand how that's affecting their business until they come all the way down and spell it out. And that is the point at which you'll start to get a sense of what it's going to be worth to this business for, you know, your intervention is going to be potentially worth to the business. But you're right about the scarcity mentality. There's a phenomenon I've seen referred to as selling to your own wallet. I first read about it in retail. So physical bricks and mortar retail, where you've got, let's say, a Tiffany Jewelers, where you're selling a $10,000 tennis bracelet, and the clerk there that works there is making like $9 an hour. And someone who is the CEO of, you know, a manufacturing company walks in, and this person has $10 million in the bank, and the person behind the counter is driving a junker to work. And there's a tendency in retail for that giant income disparity to cause the salesperson to talk the customer down to buying lower, in their opinion, is better, a better deal, a better value. Oh, you don't want to look at the $10,000 tennis bracelets. There's one for $3,000 that's just as nice. No one will ever be able to tell the difference. And I see that happen all the time in software projects when people start to do value pricing, because they're like, when they're attracting the right kinds of clients, so clients that have big projects that are really important and are risky for the business, the prices that they calculate feel astronomically high. So like, I can't charge $250,000 to this company for 6 weeks of work. I just can't bring myself to do it. They think they're not worth it. And the thing that's wild about this, because I know you talk about worth in a more personal sense than I talk about worth. When I talk about worth, it's much more of a transactional kind of worth, but I think they're related.
Yeah, I think they're deeply related.
Because what something is worth is totally subjective. If I go into a Ruth's Chris and they have like a $500 steak that's like aged and rubbed and all the things you do to steak, and it costs like $500. It's not worth that to me because I don't eat red meat. Like I'm the wrong customer for that.
Right. It's under no circumstance are you going to say like, oh, that sounds like the best idea ever.
No, I'd rather go to the dentist.
But there are other things that you'll spend $500 on.
And there are plenty of people that will spend, for whom that steak is worth $500. Another example is a bottle of wine, a really expensive bottle of wine. That is going to be worth the price to certain people. It's not going to be worth the price to other people. And so when you're in the pricing world, when you are in a position to be pricing something, you need to be cognizant of the fact that what something is worth is not a component of the thing. It's something that exists in the buyer's mind or doesn't. So to say something like, oh, well, I'm worth $300 an hour. No, you're not. It doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, you're worth what someone will pay for you.
Right. So when I hear someone say I'm worth $300 an hour, what that says to me is they won't do anything for less than $300 an hour. It does not mean that what they're doing is worth $300 an hour to anyone, anywhere.
But the real fear in that is all the people to whom you're not worth $300 an hour, for example. Like, it requires in this model for you to let a whole like swath of clients go. And that's the really like scary thing for a lot of people.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm.
How do you talk people through that? Like,
it's hard. What we're getting at here, kind of in a roundabout way, is that not everyone's your customer. Not everyone is going to have an urgent project for which they are going to spend a lot of money with you. So if you get 10 leads a year, you shouldn't be closing all 10 of them, or certainly not at first. So what that means is there's going to be a lot of you saying no, or clients saying no to you. And that can be a scary feeling. And the way that I have people do this is to say, the way to increase your close rate and have very profitable projects for both you and your client, by the way, you both stand to benefit from this model, is to get really, really specific about who you serve and what you do for them. That's where expensive problem came from. So I'll say the sort of template is I help insert target market here with insert expensive problem there. And, you know, for me, I say I help credit unions increase member engagement because member engagement is a big deal to them. I don't get into the fact that I do it through, you know, leveraging mobile or emerging technologies. That's not important yet. The thing that's important is that I help credit unions with member engagement. And if over time, the way that I do that changes, that's fine. It doesn't even matter. But what I've done there is I've picked one of many things that I could help credit unions with. And I've picked one industry out of many industries that I could help. And I've called pigeonholed myself down to this very specific thing And what that does is it allows in my marketing, which allows my marketing to be very focused. It attracts the right kind of clients. And when they come to me, it's much more likely that there is a good fit because I'm set up to attract the kind of businesses that are most likely to be a good fit. But that does mean saying no, at least in my marketing, to every other kind of business out there. You know, so if whatever Target contacted me,
a different kind of bank, a different kind of company that.
Yeah. And that scares people to death because they're like, well, right now I do anything for anyone and I'm only getting 10 leads a year and I only close two of them. So if I niche down to something that's a tenth of that, then I'm going to have a tenth of the leads and a tenth of the closed projects and I'll go out of business. But the reality is the exact opposite is what happens. It's like an inverse relationship, but you do.
You develop this expertise. You're the guy or the woman who does that thing. And you develop this really, this reputation for being excellent at this niche activity.
Yeah. You become the go-to person for your thing.
Yep.
Which allows you to do better work, which means that the outcomes are going to be better for those clients, which means you can increase your prices. And now we have a virtuous cycle instead of a race to zero.
How did you come to this, Jonathan?
Well, I have a very specific story about that. I'll try to keep it short. In 2003, I think it was, I was managing a boutique dev shop. I was the vice president and we had, I think, 10 developers at the time. And we billed everybody out hourly at the same rate. I think it was $150 an hour. And at a certain point, things were getting tight. And my boss was like, hey, you know, if we had to lay someone off, who would we lay off? And I was like, well, the first thought was, well, the most junior person. And then I was like, well, actually, we're making a ton of money off the most junior guy because we bill him out at $150 an hour. And his customers are very happy. He had a great bedside manner. And he got the work done eventually, but he was pretty slow. So we made tons of money off this guy because his salary was, say, $45,000. And then our best guy, whose salary was almost exactly double that, maybe a little more, same $150 an hour, but he would blow through work so fast that we could barely keep him busy. And I was like, wait a second. Like, from a financial standpoint,
this math doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I was like, it does not compute. So, I mean, we were lucky to have the lead dev. He was great. And I was like, wait a second, he cannot be on the chopping block. But if we're looking to save money, that's the obvious choice. So I was like, I could not figure this out. So it took me weeks of thinking about this to realize that the problem was we were hourly billing. And that's the thing that is so shocking to me, is that it was not obvious to me instantly. The fact that it was just not questioned. It was like water for fish. That's just an assumption that hourly billing is the thing. And no matter how I looked at it, if we raised our rates, he would still be our least profitable person. There's no way around it other than maybe charging different rates for different employees, but that creates other problems. So I was like, so the light bulb went on. I was like, how could this best lead developer, how could we be utilizing him better to really be making crazy money? Like, why are we losing money on this guy? And the answer that I came up with was like, well, if we priced our projects, he would be hands down, he'd be our best employee, most profitable employee. But we weren't doing that. We were selling our hands, not our heads. We were selling our time, not our outcomes. So that's when it hit me. And I started researching, like, I've never heard of anything like this. And I looked around and I found a few books on the subject from the management consulting space. And the one that it sort of became my Bible at the time is called Value-Based Fees by Alan Weiss. So I went deep on that and I tried to convince the owner of the firm, because, you know, it was a great firm, it was super fun. I loved everybody there. I tried to convince him to switch over and experiment with this, but we just couldn't imagine. It was so hard to imagine changing all the systems and changing the incentives. I mean, hourly billing is baked into firms at every level. It is just an assumption. So to change it would have been really hard. And I was like, all right, well, I got to go try this. So I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. And I went solo. Oh, this would have been in 2005, actually. I think I said 2003, because then in 2006, I started my own company and value priced from the get go and never looked back.
And now you make your living, or at least a chunk of your living, coaching people through this and helping people problem solve the things that can break down. Some of that is in strategy, but certainly a chunk of that is in psychology and working through some of the anxiety and fear and figuring out how to ask good questions and continue to press into that why question until you have enough data on which to base your price is certainly a set of skills that people can learn. They're not obvious or automatic. They're certainly counterintuitive for those of us who've come from fields where hourly pricing is highly standard.
I love it. You've done it a couple of times. Everybody does it, but you've been mixing the words pricing and billing.
Ah.
They're not the same thing. I hate correcting people about that.
No, it's okay.
It's an important distinction. When you are billing by the hour, you're not pricing at all. No one knows the price until the project's over. That's the price. And you're learning the price after the fact, which is the worst possible time to learn the price because it's too late. It's not a lamp from Target. You can't return it. So pricing is what I urge people to do, whether you use prices that are based on value or you just set prices on your website and have productized services, or you just offer products at a price. So the big shift that I try to get people to do is stop trading time for money, start giving prices to your customers, and you're going to find out that you have much happier customers and you're much happier, and you can actually create some profit, which gives you all sorts of financial cushion that makes your life a lot less stressful.
And that is, of course, what this podcast is all about, is trying to figure out how to make it a little bit easier to be an entrepreneur and to be someone who is crafting their own life based on the things that are most important to them. And it sounds like a lot of what you're talking about has tremendous value for people who have not thought about pricing in this way.
Yes. So if I was going to give advice to someone who's thinking about this or sort of like intrigued by what we're talking about here, probably if you were going to do some self-work on this, it would be to start finding out not what you think you're worth, but what your clients think you're worth. Because it's this panic attack moment happens when I'm talking to people about this, and all of a sudden they realize, rightly so, that they have no idea what they're worth or have no idea why their clients value what they do. And the only reason they know that their clients value what they do is because they pay the bills and they have very little feedback from their clients. Unless things are going horribly wrong or going amazingly well, you really don't get a lot of feedback from clients. You're just like, oh, well, they're paying the invoices every week, so I guess they're happy.
Good enough.
Yeah. But when I start to question, okay, well, why do they value what you do? How valuable is what you do to this kind of client, to that kind of client, to that kind of client? It does create an identity crisis, because all of a sudden when they make the flip from, I'm a technician who knows how to use these tools in a way that somebody values, when they flip that around and realize, like, oh, wait a second, why does anybody care that I'm really good at writing JavaScript? Nobody contacts me and says, hey, we need 2,000 lines of JavaScript by Friday. Like, no one needs JavaScript. They need the thing that they believe the JavaScript is going to deliver to their business.
They don't need the tool. They need the outcome.
Exactly. They need the business outcome. So some people will say, oh, well, the outcome I deliver is this list of features. I'm like, no, it's not. You need to go deeper. What are those features going to do for this customer? Why do they value them? Because there's 100 ways they could value them. Well, this is going to fend off our closest competitor, or this is going to capture a market opportunity that we believe is a window that's closing. We have to do it now or never. And it's going to be different for every client when you're doing this value-based stuff. So the thing to do, if you are unsure why your clients value what you do, I say ask them, especially if you've got maybe not active projects, because that can get a little sticky. But if you've got past clients, just send them an email that says, hey, I'm thinking about redoing my website, and I just wanted to get some feedback from you about, you know, how our work together changed your business for the better. What sorts of things came out of it? And I promise you, especially if you're a technical person, they're not going to say, oh, the code was so elegant and you lowered our technical debt. And they're not going to say that.
They don't know any of those things.
Nope, not at all. They're going to say things that to you seem very generic and high level and sort of hand wavy, but they are very, very real to the business person on the other end of that conversation. And that's what you're actually selling. That is those feelings or those captured opportunities, or maybe it is a cost savings, like, oh, well, you lowered our monthly Amazon Web Services bill by $30,000, so that was awesome. But it's usually a little bit more, I can sleep at night, and things like, I just feel so confident with you in our corner that I feel like I can take bigger risks, so on and so forth. And once you start to do that and start to get feedback really about what they value about what you do, then you can start to transform your marketing and perhaps eventually your products and services in such a way that pricing those outcomes becomes relatively easy. It's still, you know, it still takes some effort, but it's not scary after you start to feel some comfort with it.
I'm a little bit confused though about how you think about the value of outcomes, like I can sleep better at night, or, you know, I'm sort of asking this selfishly because those are the kinds of things that I provide for my clients, a sense of well-being, a sense of deeper identity, but those things are not as easy to measure. They're important and they're valuable to people and people are happy when they have them. But I'm thinking about trying to listen for some of those harder to quantify needs and desires in clients when you're asking those sort of why this, why now, why me kinds of things.
Yeah. So this is a huge topic. So a lot of the benefits of what we do, even if it's highly technical, the benefits are intangible. And by intangible, I mean things that won't show up on a balance sheet, something that the CFO doesn't care about. But as you well know, they are highly valuable to some people. So if you think about most of the things you buy in your life, you, Sherry, and also the dear listener, odds are good that you don't always buy the cheapest thing. Like as you're going throughout your day, there are things you buy that are not the cheapest. So for me, it's probably the most obvious example to me is like Starbucks. We spent a fortune on Starbucks. Why? Why do I do that? There are literally places right next to it that I could get cheaper coffee. Mm-hmm. It might even be better coffee. So when you think about it, the reasons are very intangible. Either I feel a sense of belonging at Starbucks. It's set up in a way that is pleasing to me. When I walk in there, I feel a particular way. The kind of people that hang out there are my kind of people. They're all working on laptops and, you know, remote workers and the people that are the sort of regulars. I fit in there, all of those things.
That sense of belonging, connection, community.
Right. And that's enough for me to spend, $8 on a large coffee and a little thing of oatmeal, which is insanely high markup. I mean, that it probably cost 50 cents to make those two things. I mean, you know, but not when you pile on all the additional expenses. I'm just talking about like if I went to the store and bought those things.
Sure.
So I'm bringing that up because I want to introduce to people that this happens with virtually every single purchase. So even though it's intangible, it is very, very real. And it exists in every, really every trade of any, you know, whether you're using money or anything else, it's you're trading one thing for another, even if you're using money as a sort of intermediary. So it's super valuable. It's super important. This is why people talk about branding, because it increases the perceived value. It's why branding is a worthwhile thing to do. But to get back to your specific question, how do you measure that? So it's impossible for you as the seller to measure it, but it is not impossible for the buyer to measure it. In fact, it's kind of easy for the buyer to measure it. And in fact, as buyers, we do this all the time. So think of the last thing that you decided not to buy because it was too expensive. You're measuring it. You're saying whatever change that, I don't know, Tesla is going to make in my life, it's not worth $120,000 to me. Like I made a judgment call. It's a measurement. It's a kind of measurement. So if you think in a situation where you're having a discussion with someone about a price and you're trying to determine the value so that you can set a price, you need to bring those things up, but you have to get a sense from the person, not from you. You have to figure out from the person how big a deal it is to them. How much, you know, are they literally losing sleep? Like you're literally losing sleep over this? Is that affecting your life in any way? Is that, you know, do you feel like your marriage is on the rocks because of this? And you get a sense of how big a deal it is.
How much pain they're in.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. And there's other, the pain's one side and the other side is sort of opportunity. So pain and growth, I think, is the other side where, you know, they have this sense that there's this huge opportunity that they want to capture or whatever it is. And they just feel like they're stuck and they want to get to the next level. You could classify them both as a pain or a longing, you know, and that person is the only person who's qualified to determine what it's worth to them. So if you're going to create individual prices for every person by having this kind of a conversation with them, you have to get better at uncovering the value in their words. So this is at the beginning, I said, this is hard. This is black magic. Even if you're doing this for a business, it's this hard because there are personal motivations behind the business goal. Because if you're talking to somebody they have the overall business motivation. Like, yes, we need to save this money on our AWS bill. And I'm like, yeah, but why do you care? It's not your money. The decision maker is not necessarily the one who's paying the bills. You know, so there's some, well, because my boss is going, oh, okay. So part of the goal here is to like get you a promotion or to help you, whatever, get a raise or.
You want to make them look good.
Right.
So they want to make themselves look good.
Sure. And I'm not saying I do that with every business discussion. Sometimes it is pretty easy to get to a tangible financial outcome, but there's tons of intangibles baked into it. And you just need to get it out of the person in a way where you are at least in an order of magnitude. So you're at least in the ballpark. So if you, Sherry, are talking to, I don't know, Elon Musk, you could price that well-being that you would provide to him way higher than you could price it to, you know, somebody who runs a pizza place, because it's worth more to him, because it's going to have a bigger impact on his life and his businesses. And it's going to have a huge follow-on impact for many, many things, the whole world, in fact. So perhaps Mars as well.
Multiple planets.
Yes. But this is not the only way to price things. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, I could never do that, that seems too hard. It's hard. Yes, you probably can do it, but it's difficult for you. And it's actually kind of emotionally challenging for the person you're talking to. So there are plenty of other ways to price things where, for example, you could just set a price for a particular outcome. So you've got experience with, say, entrepreneurs, you know, startup founders. You got experience with people who are founding bootstrap founders. There's a good one. You sort of in aggregate determine a price that is reasonable for what you can deliver for someone like that. And you could just publish that, but you don't have to have this big conversation every single time. You just price it. You put it on your website, like, this is what I do. Call it whatever, a roadmap or an action plan for your business or something from your world. I can't even guess at what it might be called, but some kind of self-assessment or personal assessment. And you could say, you know, for the people that I seek to help, the very particular kind of person who's going to have a lot of similarities between a large group. So the cohort as a whole is going to have a lot of similarities. You just set a price that is going to be reasonable to most of those people, which is a lot easier than setting a price that's going to be reasonable to everybody in the whole world. So everybody from the sales clerk at Tiffany's to Elon Musk. You can't pick a price and put it on your website that is going to be perfect for those two groups, which is why I say it just makes your life a lot easier as a business owner to focus on a very specific type of ideal buyer.
Right. And really know that audience well so that you understand all that goes into what they need and what their points of growth and points of pain are.
Mm-hmm. So you can price something, put it on your site, and you can tell if you've done it right, because once you start to get the word out, if you're selling tons of them, your price is too low. So, and you can ask them after the fact, did you feel like this was a good investment? And they'll say, yeah, it was amazing. And they'll tell you all the sort of feely things that I said before about how it changed them for the better. And people who are like them, if you take those words and put them on your site, people who are like them are going to value those feels. They're going to say, oh, God, I would give anything for that. And I hear this even from business people. One client said, if you actually do this, we're going to build a statue of you outside of our building. You know, like, you start to get comments like that that are very emotional and charged. They're emotionally charged.
Well, you're really meeting people's needs. You know, at the end of the day, that's what you're wanting to do in your career, ostensibly. And so if you can provide what people really need and exactly the way they need it by listening well, and I mean, that's a win for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So if it feels too much strain to have a why conversation with every single client, then just set a price, create a productized service and say, hey, here's a relatively fixed scope thing that I do for people like this. And people like this experience these kinds of outcomes from it. And it's $10,000. And it has nothing to do with how many hours it's going to take or how much effort you're going to put into it, because over time, you're going to be able to deliver those results faster and faster and faster, more easily, because you're getting better and better and better at it. And your price, in fact, should go up. You know, rush service is more, not less.
Right. The more efficient you become.
Yeah, you actually increase your profits by becoming more efficient instead of penalizing yourself in the hourly model. You're penalizing yourself by becoming more efficient.
I really love the way that you approach your work because of the emphasis on throwing out these old models that are somewhat arbitrary assignments of sort of monetary value to 1 hour of our time, but instead really thinking much bigger about the larger value that we as professionals provide to the people that we serve based on what they're needing. And I think there's so much like psychological nuance in what you're doing, and it requires a pretty significant amount of like psychological growth to be able to do this well.
It is a transition. Yeah.
Yeah. It just seems like it's hopefully an interesting way for people who are listening to begin to think about their work and maybe turn it on its ear and begin to think about how to do value differently. So if people want to know more about how to do this, how do they find you?
Best place would be to go to valuepricingbootcamp.com and sign up for, it's like a 7-day email course that drills into some very specific points that we've talked about here real quickly. It's sort of like delivered to you in a bite-sized format. So that's the best place to get started. And then of course you can reply to any email and that goes directly to my inbox. So if you have questions, it's the best way to get me.
Awesome. Fantastic. Hey, thanks for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure. It's great fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.